gets tough. The tough get going, 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 going. Tough, tough. When the going gets tough.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, June 3rd, 2016. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump trade nasty exchanges, trying to see who can be tough when the going gets tough. It's all happening here in California in advance of our big primary election, which is quite crucial, coming up on Tuesday, June 7th. And Hillary Clinton gave a speech in San Diego yesterday that was billed as a major foreign policy address. But in fact, it was a series of slams against Donald Trump, some related to his very bizarre positions on national security, foreign policy, and related issues. And I have to say, as you know, I am not a supporter of Hillary Rodham Clinton for president, and I believe that this speech revealed much about her that I've been talking about for months, if not years. But she gave an excellent speech. It was well written. She delivered it from a teleprompter, and she did okay. I have to say that what she really did well was in her tone and delivery. Because often when she gets in front of a crowd and Hillary starts to raise her voice, and people have criticized her for this, I'm not alone in making this observation, she can come off as kind of shrill and hard to listen to. But in this speech, she was very much in command, and she delivered a series of attack lines on Trump, quoting his comments or tweets in some cases, and calling him out as unfit to be president. And I agree with the case that she made. And some of the lines were clever about how he believes that we can treat the U.S. economy like one of his casinos, that he doesn't have a clue about what he's talking about. He doesn't see the complexity. This isn't reality television, she said. This is actual reality. And one of her funnier lines was about how there's no risk of people losing their lives if you blow up a golf course deal. But it doesn't work like that in world affairs. The stakes in global statecraft are infinitely higher and more complex than in the world of luxury hotels. Now, some of these sound bites, I think, are highly effective, highly quotable. At one point, she said, "I'll leave it to the psychiatrist to explain Donald Trump's affection for tyrants." And this is where she leaned in to her neocon portfolio as Secretary of State and as a member of the United States Senate in the past. And Bob Perry, my friend Robert Perry at ConsortiumNews.com, did an excellent job of breaking it down for us today. I'm linking to his commentary called "The Bigger Nuclear Risk, Trump or Clinton?" It's in the show file for today's podcast. And this is what I think is really important about the speech that Clinton delivered in San Diego. Because while she clearly showed a greater command and a more stable personality than Donald Trump, she also comes across as extremely belligerent, and she was using these neocon applause lines, demonizing Russia and Vladimir Putin and trying to link Trump to Putin. I mentioned that line about tyrants just a moment ago. And so while Hillary Clinton feels that she is strong and that she shows this command of foreign policy, I think that her speech exposed who she really is. And it's why I fear her as the potential next president of the United States. And Bob Perry writes, in Clinton's worldview, Putin, who's been elected multiple times and has approval ratings around 80% in Russia, is nothing more than a dictator who is engaged in aggression that threatens NATO following the U.S.-backed regime change in Ukraine. And Perry says, but stop for a second and think about what Clinton said. She sees Russia responding to an unconstitutional coup in Ukraine, which we supported, and which installed a virulently anti-Russian regime on Russia's border, as Moscow acting aggressively on NATO's doorstep. And Perry continues, that's the same NATO whose job it was to protect Western Europe from the Soviet Union, and after that, it added country after country right up to Russia's border. In other words, NATO muscled its way into Russia's face and has announced plans to incorporate Ukraine as well. But when Russia reacts, it's the one doing the provoking. Perry writes, Clinton's neoconservative interpretation of what's happening in Eastern Europe is so upside down and inside out that it could ultimately become the flashpoint for a nuclear war between Russia and the West. And this is the kind of hawkishness that I have deep concerns about. And Clinton doesn't even try to disguise them or really play them down in any diplomatic fashion. And we know that Victoria Nuland, who is, part of the neocon establishment, who served Hillary at the State Department, who is a lead advisor on foreign policy issues for her presidential campaign, and will likely have a major role if Clinton becomes president. Well, we know that Victoria Nuland bragged about how the U.S. helped bring down the elected but corrupt government in Ukraine. So I encourage you to read this piece because I think Bob Perry has done an excellent job. And let's listen to an excerpt or two of Hillary Clinton's speech in San Diego yesterday.
Because as you know so well, Americans aren't just electing a president in November. We're choosing our next commander-in-chief, the person we count on to decide questions of war and peace, life and death. And like many across our country and around the world, I believe the person the Republicans have nominated for president cannot do the job. Donald Trump's ideas aren't just different. They are dangerously incoherent. They're not even really ideas, just a series of bizarre rants, personal feuds, and outright lies. He is not just unprepared. He is temperamentally unfit to hold an office that requires knowledge, stability, and immense responsibility. This is not someone who should ever have the nuclear codes, because it's not hard to imagine Donald Trump leading us into a war just because somebody got under his very thin skin. We cannot put the security of our children and grandchildren in Donald Trump's hands. We cannot let him roll the dice with America. This is a man who said that more countries should have nuclear weapons, including Saudi Arabia. This is someone who has threatened to abandon our allies in NATO, the countries that work with us to root out terrorists abroad before they strike us at home. He believes we can treat the U.S. economy like one of his casinos and default on our debts to the rest of the world, which would cause an economic catastrophe far worse than anything we experienced in 2008.
So Clinton does really put in a powerful set of indictments about Donald Trump, and I don't particularly disagree with what she said. Again, it's her posture, her worldview, that is revealed in this speech that I think people need to very carefully reflect on. So the Donald was appearing in San Jose last night. He had a half-filled convention center there. About 7,500 people showed up. And in true style, he ranted and raved and counterattacked Hillary Clinton. And he began by saying that she has to go to jail. He says, I've read so much about her emails, and I have to say she's guilty as hell. Now, this puts me in an awkward spot, because I believe that Hillary Clinton broke the law, and that she is quite vulnerable about her emails. But I'm loath to pronounce her guilty at this point because she hasn't been formally charged of anything. And I guess I'm old school because, unlike Donald Trump, I'm not willing to just jump to a conclusion and pronounce someone guilty as hell without some form of due process. And so while it's appealing to hear Trump make these kinds of judgments or pronouncements, it's highly irresponsible. And it just is another example of how he shoots from the lip and will just keep pursuing these lines of attack without ever providing policy prescriptions or any real detail about how he would be different from his opponent, in this case, Mrs. Clinton. And at the rally in San Jose, after saying that Clinton has to go to jail, he said that if he becomes president, there's a 5-year statute of limitation, and if I'm elected, I'm sure my attorney general will be taking a good long look, and from the fairest point of view, he said. Now, that kind of mirrors what he has been saying this week that has really troubled a lot of people. And that is that in the case of Trump University, where we have a California judge who has a Mexican surname, but he is an American born in Indiana of parents who became citizens after migrating from Mexico, and his name is Gonzalo Curiel. And simply based on his name, Trump has said he's a Mexican, and in these mob scenes that he creates of people who want him to build that wall, that is an extremely racist charge. And so this you know, just creates these layers of problems that Trump promotes and that his supporters appear to relish. And in the New York Times today, there's an excellent piece, and it's based mostly on commentary from conservatives and Republicans, that his blustery attacks on the press, his complaints about the judicial system, and his bold claims of presidential power sketch out a constitutional worldview that shows contempt for the First Amendment, the separation of powers, and the rule of law. And this is a very fair criticism. He gets up on his podium and he just says he's going to make the water flow in California, he's going to build a wall, he's going to make Carrier pay a 35% tariff to bring air conditioners into the country that they build in Mexico. And he never says, I'm going to work with the Congress to pass a law. He acts as if, as a dictator, he can simply decree, and things will then follow his orders. He's taken attacks now at Jeff Bezos. I'm no fan of the Amazon founder who bought the Washington Post, but he is threatening, if he becomes president, that he's going to create problems for Jeff Bezos. He says he owns Amazon. He wants political influence, so Amazon will benefit from it. That's not right. And believe me, if I become president, oh, do they have problems. They're going to have such problems. Well, this is demagoguery. It is authoritarianism. And despite the fact that I can't support Hillary Clinton, she did call out Donald Trump in a very accurate and detailed way in her San Diego speech yesterday. After the Trump rally in San Jose on Thursday night, the Mercury News, the local paper, reports dozens of fights broke out in the streets of downtown San Jose as police in riot gear struggled to keep the peace between hundreds of protesters and Donald Trump fans. And many of the protesters were calling on each other to maintain a peaceful approach, but we know that some punches were thrown, some people were wrestled to the ground, and I believe there have been 4 arrests from the skirmishes on the streets of Silicon Valley. Here in California, as I mentioned, the critical primary is on Tuesday, and Greg Pallast, who has done a great job alerting us to election fraud and manipulation, posted yesterday, and I want to thank, I think it's Merle in Michigan, or no, Jerry Fresia. He emailed me with a link to this. And it's important for people to understand, if you are registered as a Democrat in California, you should have no problem whether you vote by mail or at the polls. You will be given a Democratic ballot. But if, like me, you have been registered as a no-party preference voter, you have to affirmatively request a Democratic ballot. And if you choose to vote by mail and you didn't notify your county registrar by the end of May, they're not going to send you a presidential ballot at all. Now, if that happens to you, you have the option still to show up at the polls on Tuesday. You give them, you turn in your absentee ballot, and they will give you a live ballot. Again, if you're a no party preference registrant, you have the right to request a Democratic presidential ballot. But Greg Pallast got word from a poll worker in Orange County. She said she was being trained with other poll workers. Quote, I was told that all no party preference voters are to be given provisional ballots. I was bothered by that because I was always told that NPP voters in California can vote for Democrats and their vote would be counted. I was a little worried that he was telling all 18 of us poll workers to give all NPP voters provisional ballots. We all know what happens most of the time with provisional ballots. They are not counted. And that's why Greg Pallast refers to them as placebo ballots. Here at the PBC podcast, I've been covering issues of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement aimed at Israel, aimed at getting Israel to change its racist and ugly policies related to the Palestinians and to non-Jews who live in the state of Israel. And there is more action on this front. I've been telling you about a really bad bill that has been amended so that it's kind of a meaningless resolution. In the California lower house, it's called AB 2844. And so far, there has been no vote on AB 2844. So it remains amended and relatively toothless in its effort to create a blacklist of businesses that support the boycott against Israel. And in exchange, if you get placed on that blacklist, you can't do contracting work for any public entity in California. So, as I say, the law has been amended even to raise questions about its own constitutionality, which I think is quite appropriate. But at the United Nations yesterday, the new ambassador from Israel, Danny Dannon, and Ronald Lauder, he is the son of Estée Lauder, the cosmetics fortune, and he also is a very strong Zionist. This isn't really relevant, but one of my brothers used to work for Ronald Lauder, so I know a little bit about him. At any rate, he was there, and once again, they engage in this language where they accuse principled individuals like me who support boycotting Israel because of its racist policies as anti-Semitic. And my support of BDS is not to destroy the state of Israel. It's to get it to honor international law and moral standards and to stop persecuting the Palestinians. But Danny Dannon says that it is flatly anti-Semitism and that BDS activists are hypocrites who should be exposed through every means possible. But they trotted out an advertising executive from Young and Rubicam. And he said, you know, not every Jew who supports BDS is an ignorant, self-hating Jew. He said, BDS is driving the conversation, and the anti-BDS side is reactionary. Ours is a negative message, just not that inviting. We look like a corporate brochure, so we have a problem, my friends. Then they trot out the spinmeister, Frank Luntz, the Republican guy who helps create a special language to demagogue issues. And he says that BDS is winning more sympathy in the United States. But then he went on to say that it is the Palestinian narrative, and this is what happens if you remain silent. So the state of Israel has budgeted $26 million this year to combat the BDS movement. And I mention that in linkage to this next story, but I am not directly accusing or even inferring that the state of Israel is known to be responsible for a swarm of denial-of-service attacks on websites, more than half a dozen, linked to the BDS movement. The central website, bdsmovement.net, was targeted for a massive denial-of-service attack. They have a company that tries to defend them from cyber attacks that monitors the efforts for denial-of-service. And they said that it was a sophisticated approach that is not generally seen in this hacker's world. So, again, I can't in any way prove that the State of Israel is behind those denial of service attacks, but I would say they have to be considered a suspect. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And that includes a lot of great individuals. People like Faith Peoples, Nick Yaksich, Bob Donjakour, and, oh yeah, Faith Peoples. And I mentioned Faith twice because Faith has more than one monthly subscription. That's how generous she is. So I want to invite you to become a subscriber. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, and I want to thank some recent signups. We'll be mentioning you in the next few days. But there has been a flurry of activity, and that's always a way to make me feel good because it says people value what I'm doing here. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on menu, then you click on become a subscriber. On the sign-up page, you can see our bonus books for new annual subscribers who provide a mailing address in the continental U.S., and you can sign up for $5 a month, $10, $20, whatever fits your budget. I very much appreciate your support. And I also want to thank people because we started distributing a short video, a two-minute clip, starring yours truly, with an update about NewsBud and a look at our newly refurbished secret studio where we're now set up for video. And yesterday I didn't do a news and comment podcast because I spent the whole day working on our first NewsBud report. And it's in the edit bay right now, and we should see it released sometime in the next few days. And that, of course, is for NewsBud.com. And the NewsBud Kickstarter campaign is reinvigorated now. We picked up about $5,000 in the last day or so. We're currently at $110,000, on our way to the goal of $150,000 in this first phase. So please, don't let up. If you haven't yet contributed, I invite you to do so. If you've already contributed, you've got my thanks. And I encourage you to spread that video around, perhaps with your personal endorsement. We're getting close to the end of the term of the divided Supreme Court with only 8 members since the death of Antonin Scalia. And the court on Tuesday took action in 2 death penalty cases that are revealing in different ways. A case from Louisiana asked the justices to consider the question of whether the death penalty itself is constitutional. And Justice Stephen Breyer, who in a case last year raised that issue, took the lead. And he and only one other justice, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, agreed to hear the case. And this is a case of a man who was 18 at the time he was accused of murder. He had an IQ of 74. The Supreme Court has previously banned the execution of juvenile offenders and of the mentally disabled. And Justice Breyer wrote, "Tucker was sentenced to death in a Louisiana county that's called Caddo Parish that imposes almost half of the death sentences in Louisiana, even though it accounts for only 5% of that state's population and only 5% of its homicides. Given these facts, Tucker may well have received the death penalty, not because of the comparative egregiousness of his crime, but because of an arbitrary feature of his case, namely geography." Now, since Ginsburg was the only other justice to join in, we have to assume that the Obama appointees, Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, are not interested in reviewing the constitutionality of the death penalty. It was served to them on a silver platter, and they joined the right-wing members of the court to deny hearing the appeal. And in a second case from Arizona, the court reversed a death sentence in an unsigned opinion because the jury had not been told an important fact that the only alternative to a death sentence that the jury could consider was life without the possibility of parole. That's a very important matter, and I'm glad to see the court, despite its pro-capital punishment stance, take the position that it did. Jason Leopold has done it again with Freedom of Information Act released documents. He is fleshing out what we know about the death of a prisoner in CIA custody back in 2002. And this was a man who was being held at a black site in Afghanistan, and he ended up dying. Now, he wasn't killed during a torture proceeding. But they did torture him, and then they used what's called short shackling. They had him handcuffed and shackled to a grate in his cell. They left him nude from the waist down in 30-degree temperatures, and he expired overnight. They're claiming it was simply hypothermia that caused it. But in the lengthy breakdown that Jason Leopold brings us, they show that the death of this man, whose name was Rahman, was Ghul Rahman, that his case did draw the attention of authorities in Washington. They said that one of the key individuals should be disciplined, and the recommendation was 10 days without pay. Ultimately, there was no discipline meted out, and in fact, the person responsible for the death of the captive named Rahman got a $2,500 bonus a couple of months later. It's an important story, and it's based on the trial that's underway in Spokane, Washington right now, of the two men who served as consultants to the CIA in developing the torture programs, Mitchell and Jessen. And this is a case that I'm watching carefully, and we'll probably set up an interview with Jason Leopold to go into detail about that in the near future. In other news, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a creation of the Dodd-Frank law, and its director, Richard Cordray, have finally issued some new proposed guidelines or rules related to payday loan, these predatory lenders to the most vulnerable people in our communities. And these are the, you know, short-term, very high-interest loans. The interest rate can skyrocket on the face of it up to 30%. And when you roll over unpaid loans, you can end up paying interest rates as high as 390%. I mean, it's just egregious, and it should be completely outlawed. But they're trying to put some rules in place, and while the rules have been totally watered down, the industry says, oh, no, this is going to kill us, and we're not going to be able to loan money to people to pay their utility bills and then pay us back at 150%. Even the New York Times, in its editorial on Friday, says that this is a lame response to predatory loans because some rules that had been considered have been eliminated, and the pattern will continue that people who borrow money on these terms will not be evaluated by the lenders to see just how much it will ruin their financial lives. Over at Yahoo, they got a request from the FBI to see email records. The notification came in the form of a national security letter. And to its credit, Yahoo made public this recent demand and noted that it didn't comply for the most part. And the issue is that since 2008, the FBI has known that it doesn't have the legal right to demand our emails via a national security letter. They need to have an actual warrant. And this is an important issue because there is, as I mentioned last week, a bill that cleared the Senate Intelligence Committee on a 14-1 vote with only Ron Wyden of Oregon dissenting. And it relates to this very same issue. They're trying to ram through legislation to enable the FBI to gather this information through these self-executed, they're not warrants, but these orders. And Ron Wyden said the Justice Department told FBI officials that if they want to demand Americans' email records, they need a court order. But the FBI has crossed the line when it comes to this electronic information, even after being explicitly told under the Bush administration, no less, that they were not legally authorized to demand these personal records absent a court order. So the creeping police state, the national surveillance state, they continue to expand. Glenn Greenwald has another update at The Intercept about the state of affairs in Brazil. And Michel Temer, who is the acting president since they have put Dilma Rousseff, the elected president, on an impeachment track, has been notified that his situation is so bad that he is being banned from running for elective office for the next 8 years. So he can serve as the interim president, but he could not be elected made permanent in that post, at least not through any ordinary democratic process. Greenwald goes on to note that the effort to use this, what he calls a coup, to protect the corrupt individuals implicated in the so-called car wash investigation is faltering, and that a couple of people that Temer appointed, including his anti-corruption minister, have been forced to resign after secret recordings showed them plotting to obstruct the investigation into car wash while throwing Dilma Rousseff out of office. And it's a very complex and dire situation there in Brazil. With the Olympics coming up in August, we have an American competitor who has bailed out of the Olympics because his wife is pregnant and he doesn't want to come home with Zika. And we now hear that the Zika virus, according to the New England Journal of Medicine, can be spread through kissing and possibly oral sex. They only have one incident of the oral sex transmission, but the case involved a French man who returned to Paris from Rio in February of this year, and we know too much about his private life. He and his 24-year-old partner had sex 7 times in a week or so. Good for them. Each involving vaginal sex without ejaculation and oral sex with ejaculation. And shortly after, she tested positive for the Zika virus, as did he. This is sad. I like to watch the military high-performance jet groups when they perform in the skies. I always have mixed feelings because I think it's a real ugly display of American military power. But I'm awestruck by the technology and by the proficiency of these pilots who can fly in formation and do all those stunts. And yesterday, two of the service units' fighter jet groups suffered crashes. The Navy Blue Angels lost an F-A-18 fighter jet as a pilot was unable to eject and was killed when the aircraft crashed outside Smyrna, Tennessee, on a training episode. And within hours yesterday, there was a flyover of the Thunderbirds at the Air Force Academy graduation where President Obama spoke. And one of the Thunderbirds crashed near Colorado Springs, but that pilot did eject safely. Yesterday, the German parliament overwhelmingly adopted a symbolic but very weighty resolution declaring that the killings of Armenians by Ottoman Turks in 1915 was, in fact, a genocide. To me, this is a very simple issue that revolves around the definition of genocide, and I think a sufficient number of Armenians were brutally killed by the Turks in 1915 that that's an accurate term. But we've seen that the Turks are extremely touchy about this, and they use Speaker Dennis Hastert and other supporters in Washington to block similar resolutions by the Congress time after time. But in Germany, they passed this, and now the Erdogan government in Ankara is angrily denouncing the vote as null and void. They're threatening to retaliate against Germany. And for what? A rewrite of history? I don't get it. And finally today, I just want to note that some of my listeners may be battling floods. In Paris, the Seine has overflowed, threatening two of my favorite museums, the Musée d'Orsay and the Louvre. And I've been in the lower floors of the Louvre, where once upon a time there was a dungeon, and I just hope that that hasn't been breached and is seeing leaks. In Bavaria, there are massive floods in that portion of Germany, and also Houston, Texas is the site of large-scale floods near the Cold Springs and Owl Creeks. And three soldiers who were trying to help rescue individuals, soldiers from Fort Hood, were killed in those rescue efforts yesterday. Thanks for joining me for News and Comment today. As always, you're welcome to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you.